Oh, we have such a privilege today. We get to look at the book of Daniel. We're going to look at the opening chapter of Daniel. The last couple of weeks that we've talked out of, we've taught out of Luke 2, the story of Jesus, who is a young 12-year-old, grew in wisdom and in stature, favor of God and man, how he became a strong man, says Luke 40. And so what I just sense God leading me to do is look at Daniel, who is not 12, although we're not certain of that, but probably he's maybe 15 in the book of Daniel chapter 1. And so let me show you the context. Can we show the map, if you will? Okay, as we go into the book of Daniel, the opening chapter, the year that the year is 605 B.C., you see the map still? You good? Okay, the year is 605 B.C. in chapter 1, verse 1. And let me show you the map. This is a map of the Middle East in the 7th century B.C. This is, of course, the Mediterranean Sea. Everything that you see in the green, okay, everything in the green, here all the way through Egypt, this is the kingdom of Babylon in the 7th century B.C. The yellow, by the way, this is Media Persia. And in the future, not too distant future, Media Persia is actually going to defeat Babylon. And all of this will become the Persian Empire. Of course, Persia is modern-day Iran. Babylon is modern-day, located where modern-day Iraq is. This is the Tigris River. Here's the Euphrates River. Here's Nineveh, the capital of Babylon. Here is Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem right here. And here's Egypt on this side, the Sinai Peninsula. Saudi Arabia is down here. Modern-day Syria up here, and Turkey up there. And what happens in the year 600 B.C. is that Jerusalem is a very strong country. And, of course, Jerusalem is the city of the nations, so to speak. That's what Ezekiel describes Jerusalem. It's also the capital city of Judah, the people of Israel, and it is where the temple is located. And what happens is that Babylon, beginning with King Manasseh, leads Israel through a period of some just puts them on the wrong path. Manasseh is a king that doesn't go the way of the Lord. He is evil. He oppresses the poor. He's anything but godly. And so Manasseh begins a string of a reign of Israelite kings that are far outside of God's will. And it's interesting because what the Old Testament shows us, particularly because it has history in it, what the Old Testament shows us is that when the leader of the country goes a way contrary to the will of the Lord, what happens is that it impacts the people of that land. It's almost like a cancer. It's like the leader catches a cancer, and then all the people, because they are influenced by that leader, they sort of catch the same cancer and leads the people away from God. And there's a king that rises up, Josiah, who brings about revival in Israel. And what that does is Josiah's revival sort of brings the people of Israel back into God's will. And it sort of, because of what Josiah does, he pushes back an eventual abandonment of the people of their God and an abandonment of God of the people. Such that Babylon's destruction of Jerusalem is pushed back because of Josiah. But Josiah had three sons. All three of those sons did not go the way of their father. And as we open in the opening chapter of Daniel, one of those sons is the king when Babylon launches its first of three sieges of Jerusalem in 605 B.C. They launch that siege of Jerusalem, and they conquer Jerusalem. And what happens is, they in the conquering of Jerusalem, Babylon takes the key individuals, a large portion of the population, but it's only the rich and the wealthy and the noble, the people of consequence, of influence. They take them from Jerusalem back into Babylon. Now, that's all the context. That's how we enter the story. But here's sort of where we're going to go. Where we're going to go is this. I believe with all of my heart, that someone's relationship with God is the most important thing in their entire life. If I didn't believe this, I wouldn't be a pastor. I would not be a preacher. But I believe with all of my heart, the most important factor in anyone's life is their relationship with God. It's like in Matthew 7, he says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." And so, because I see that is so important, what I'd look at in the book of Daniel and see Daniel and try to understand how did this man accomplish what he did? Interesting, because Daniel is the only man in the entire Old Testament where nothing is ever stated that he does wrong. You know, all the other leaders, at some point they made some failure, some stumble, but not Daniel. And what we have to remember is when Daniel is taken into captivity by the Babylonians, he's probably 15 years old. Do you realize that Daniel is going to be in Babylonian captivity for 70 years? In fact, he will never again see his homeland. He'll never again step into the city of Jerusalem. He'll go through four pagan kings, both Babylonian kings and Persian kings. Daniel will go through all of those kings. He will be one of the top administrative helpers and assistants of all four of those kings, but Daniel will never stray. He will never fall into their pattern of worshiping a foreign god. He will never do that. And so what that begs the question: why? How come? What is so special about Daniel? And my answer to that, and I think you see this particularly in the opening chapter of Daniel, is that it is his relationship with God. Daniel is not about keeping the rules. Daniel is about loving his God. And what happens when you and I love our God? What happens when you love your God? What happens is that it allows you to accomplish far more than you ever would have accomplished by yourself. Because God's Spirit transforms a human heart. And so what Daniel represents a person, a man of God, whose relationship with God transformed him and allowed him to do things he otherwise could not have done for no other reason than because God was present in him and with him. Let me show you. Okay, Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar. Shinar would be Babylon. He brought them to the house of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of God. Now, let me ask you a question. Why do you think Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, why do you think the text tells us that he brought only some of the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem to his house of his God in Babylon? Why do you think he only brought some of them? Because he's coming back. He doesn't need to pack them all up right now. In fact, what's going to happen is there are three separate sieges of Jerusalem. The first one in 605 B.C. Another one takes place 10 years later, and the final one takes place in 586 B.C. when the entire temple is destroyed and Jerusalem is leveled to the ground. And so Nebuchadnezzar, what he does is he establishes a vassal relationship with Jerusalem, with Israel, whereby every year Israel will pay a tax to the Babylonian king. And that tax is high enough so that Israel will still stay alive. The people of Israel will be able to produce and survive and live Because he doesn't want it to be so high that it takes him into what you might call bankruptcy. He wants him to live. He has a group of captives. He wants him to live, but he wants his annual tax payment. And so what happens is he establishes his payment, Israel pays the payment, and then Jehoiakim, the king that is in the text, in the third year, he rebels. He don't want to pay it anymore. Because, see, here's what Jehoiakim believes. Jehoiakim believes that the temple is in Jerusalem. The temple has the name of the Lord on it. Jerusalem is a city of the Lord. It is for the people of God who are named by God. And so Jehoiakim, in spite of the fact that he's been outside of God's will, his entire kingship, Jehoiakim believes that God will not abandon Israel and that Babylon will never destroy Jerusalem. That's sort of arrogant, don't you think? You think America has a similar arrogance? Well, I'll let you just think that one. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. He brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had the ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now, what we need to understand is when he says he's bringing these men so that they can, these young men, so they can serve in the king's court, you need to realize that that is quite an honor. That is quite an opportunity for a captive in Babylon. To be able to serve in the king's court is a good thing. The king's going to give you what other people don't have who are captives in Babylon. Notice the size of this kingdom. There are people, there are slaves in Babylon that go far beyond just Jerusalem. They're from every country within that area of the green. And so for anyone to be chosen to come into the king's personal service was an honor. It was an opportunity. But here's what has to happen. In order for someone to come into the king's service, into this area, what has to happen is they have to sort of lose their past identity. Okay? They have to lose their past identity. Because what's got to happen is if you're going to serve the king, then what you need to do is you need to be about what the king's about. And so what's happening in the text, what it describes is a process whereby the Babylonians try to change the past identity, the spiritual identity of all of their captives who are in the ploy of the king. So how do they do that? How they do it is, it says they choose the top of the line, cream of the crop. You got that? And Daniel is in the cream of the crop. And Daniel's about 15. Verse 5, and the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years. They're going to private school. They're going to Yale. They're going to Harvard. This is what's going on. They're going to be educated for 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now, among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They're four men, young men from Judah. Verse 7. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, and to Azariah, Abednego. Now let me see the next graph if I can. Okay, so what we see is that the king and his head helper, what he's done is he's going to teach him the Babylonian language. He's going to teach them about Babylonian literature. He's going to elevate Babylon in their minds, in the process try to replace their Judaistic, their history, their Jewishness. He wants them to let go of their Jewishness so that they become Babylonian. Now notice how they do that. What they do is they change their names. They change their names. Daniel's name before this was God is my judge. That would be Jehovah God is my judge. They changed his name to Belteshazzar, meaning Prince of Bel. Bel was another foreign god of the Babylonians, so he is now called the Prince of Bel. You know, it seemed like that even in the choice of Daniel's name, there's something about Daniel that distinguishes him as a leader. Okay? Now, then the next one is Hananiah. His name in Hebrew means beloved of the Lord. Beloved of the Lord. They change it to Shadrach, illumined by the sun god. Okay, if everywhere you went in Babylon, you were called Shadrach, illumined by the sun god. You learn what your name meant. You know, I mean, I can imagine, you know, as they went around the people of Israel and they would, you know, they would call them different names. Say, what does your name mean? It means illumined by the sun god. I mean, it's like what's happening here is that the Babylonians are trying to change the way they think about their God. They're trying to change the way they think about whose God he is. What does he mean to them? What is represented by that name? So that another God replaces Jehovah God. Then the next one is Michelle. His Hebrew name means who is God or who is as God. They change it to Meshach. Notice it's simply a slight change in how you say the word. And now that name means who is like unto the moon god. You know, why didn't the Babylonians name them something like, I don't know, fast as, I don't know, a bullet. I don't know. I mean, in other words, why aren't the names something other than the pagan deity? They're trying to change the spiritual identity of each one of these young men. Now, what does that have to do with you and me? I was at Mount Hermon's graduation this past Thursday. We had a good crew of our kids that graduated. Nick graduated. I think I saw Nick. There's Nick graduated. James graduated. And 4 or 5 of our young people graduated from Mount Hermon High School. Now, here's what I noticed. I'm reading the program, and out of, I don't know, 300 and something young people who graduated from Mount Hermon High School, I bet you, and I'm just guessing, I bet you there were 30 to 40% who had foreign names. Now, what's wrong with that? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But think about this, okay? You know, it's like, you know, in Orangeburg High School, when I graduated from my graduating class of 125, the question was not, you know, how many foreigners we had in my class. That was not, I did go through Orangeburg High School through integration. And so, the question may have been about the color of skin, but not in terms of nationalities. And here's our danger, though. Okay, our children, our young people, are growing up in a system whereby we have people from all nationalities. And that is hallelujah, praise the Lord. Okay, that's the way it ought to be. I think that's wonderful. That they're getting that opportunity. But if you grow up in an education system, how is it possible? In fact, as I looked at all those names, I thought about the challenge to our education people in trying to make sure that all of these young kids of different nationalities are able to coexist without being violent towards one another, without being prejudiced towards one another. And, you know, it's like I could see why we need policies that help our young people to accept those who are different. Okay? Please don't hear me ever saying anything that says that would imply we're not to accept people who are different. Because heaven is certainly going to be filled with different people. God would certainly want us to relate in a politically correct way to those who are different. You know, this is a land of multiple nationalities. That's a good thing. That's who we are. But our challenge is, if we grow up in a society with multiple different nationalities. How can we protect our children's mind so that in spite of the fact that we have many different nationalities, we don't all of a sudden, they don't all of a sudden conclude, well, then there must really be many ways to God. It's like the way to God for a believer in Jesus Christ is defined by His Word. And so, on the one hand, we must teach our children to accept others and to welcome differences and to welcome uniqueness, to welcome that and support it and stand beside others. But it doesn't mean that we change truth. Doesn't mean we redefine truth. It doesn't mean that the Babylonians, so to speak, change the way we think about God, who God is and who I am before God. You understand what I'm trying to say? Okay, let's keep going. Look at verse 8. So here's what Daniel does. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. So here's Daniel. Daniel enters a situation. He's in a different land, a different people group, and what happens is it's like he's put in a position where what he's expected to do is the same as everybody else is doing. You see, okay? What's happened is Daniel is being asked to do exactly what everybody else is doing in his structure, in his system. So how do we respond as believers in Jesus Christ when we live in a multicultural culture, society, and we're expected to do and believe what everybody else believes? For example, my oldest son, John, told me about, John is in charge of a mission that evangelizes students on College Park, on the University of Maryland at College Park. He tells me about how many times that he will talk about Christ as an apologist. He talks about Christ as an apologist and what he talks about Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life, the only way to God. And he told me how it amazes him how many people will say to him, you know, I can't believe you Christians are all alike. You think that you have the only way to God. And the person says, you know, you think you have the only way to God and that none of these other ways. And it's like what the person says to John is, you know, you need to drop that view because that is a politically incorrect view. It's not an acceptable view in the multicultural society we have. And John told me, he said something like, well, so you're saying that what I have to do is adopt your view, which is, there are many ways to God. He says, well, aren't you requiring me to do exactly what you say that I am doing, being narrow-minded? Well, I mean, you understand his logic. It's like, okay, if I've got to accept the fact that there are many ways, that's a particular faith system, okay? And it's no different to believe that Jesus Christ is the way and the truth and the life and no one comes to the Father is no different than the belief that says there's got to be many ways. We both hold to our own particular individual beliefs and neither is different than the other. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. He would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank, so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. See, it's not about whether he likes the meat. It's not about whether he likes the wine. It's not a lot about whether he likes the special food. But to a Jew, that food would defile him because it had been offered to idols. What they would do in that day is they would sacrifice animals on an altar. The blood would stay on the altar, and then they would take the meat and they would eat it. And a Jew is not to eat meat that's been sacrificed on an altar, to an idol. And so it was a defilement. It was a spiritual defilement. It's not about the food. It's not about the diet. Verse 9, now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence as the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better. They were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king talked with them. And out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king, 70 years. So here's where we're going. Here's what the text is telling us. The text is showing us that God wants to do more in our lives with him than we can do otherwise. And how is that possible? How is it that seeking God, how is it seeking him first, that all these things will be added unto us? How is it that it works? Here's how it worked for Daniel. How it worked for Daniel is first in verse 8. Verse 8 says, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. It's like what Daniel is doing is he's deciding to do something in advance. Don't ever think when it comes to the difficult decisions in life that you and I have to make on a daily basis, don't ever think that the time that you make those decisions, I mean, if you know that it's coming, don't ever think that what you ought to do is delay your decision. Because once God reveals to you that something is coming down the pipe that is going to challenge you spiritually, what he's saying is, Daniel decided in advance. He had decided what he was going to do. And now all that's left is the doing. You know, God can speak to you. He can tell you this. He can tell you that to do. And you can talk about it and think about it in your head and do all this stuff. But until you decide, I have decided, this is what I'm going to do in this particular situation. Until you decide, you see, nothing's going to take place. It's like God will lead us. God will lead us right up to, he'll lead us right up to where we're supposed to move, but he won't make you decide. He won't make you decide. And what Daniel does first is he decides. He makes up his mind. It's like what I think you find in Daniel's life is you find a young man. This is not the first time Daniel has decided to obey the Lord. Daniel is 15 years old. He's in captivity. Can you imagine the pressure that is on Daniel and all of these young men when they come into Babylon to follow the plan, to follow the protocol, to do what you're supposed to do, to not get out of the lines? All of the pressure is on them. Daniel doesn't decide this at age 15. Daniel as a little boy. You know, if you want a story that would encourage a church to have a ministry to children, it's the story of Daniel. Because I can assure you, this didn't start right here. Look at his name. God is my judge. Look at Hananiah, beloved of the Lord. Mishael, who is as God. Azariah, the Lord is my help. All of these names are names that are given by parents who know the Lord. I can assure you that the parents of these young men led their children to know the Lord. They modeled it. You know, involved in Sunday school, involved in what's going into the church. These young men, they were prepared and ready. See, comes time to this. They've already learned how to be faithful. You know, Jesus talks about, Jesus says something in Luke. He says, he who is faithful in little will be faithful in much. You know what that little is? Faithful in little. You know what the verse has reference to? Joseph, bet you know that verse. You know what the context of that passage is? He who is faithful, he who is not faithful with his money, the little things, will not be faithful with the big things. It's like, you know, money, tithing. You know what God says? You know why God talks? Today's not a sermon about tithing, but the point is, it's like every Sunday you have an opportunity to be faithful in the little things. And why should you be faithful in the little? Because what they do is help us to be faithful in the big. This is a big thing. This is a big thing. And so Daniel has made a decision. He's getting ready to do it. Next thing I want you to see that Daniel does is he submits to the authority of those who are over him. Daniel submits to the authority of those that God places around him. That when the opening passage says that God gave the people of Israel over to the Babylonians, what the text is telling us is this, is that long time ago, the people of Israel went the way of their king. They went the way of their evil king, and because they went the way of their evil king, they abandoned God. And now because they have abandoned God, God has given them over to their choice. Daniel and his four friends look at the captivity in Babylon as not so much something that has gone wrong, but something that is in God's will. It is within God's will. And so the captivity is God's will. And so now what happens is Daniel and his friends are able to come under the Babylonians. They're learning the language. They're learning the language. They're learning the literature. They're taking the names. There's nothing in the text that has Daniel or his friends copying an attitude and saying, how dare you do such and such? You mean you want me to learn this language? I am not going to do it. There's nothing in this text that indicates that. Daniel is coming under the authority of the Caesar that he is placed in that situation. So what am I saying? You know, if you're in a work situation and you can't talk about Jesus because of one reason or another, and if you talk about Jesus, you're going to be fired. You know what? You need to be sure that what you use is wisdom about how you stand up for Christ. Now, I'm not talking out of two sides of my mouth. Daniel has submitted to the authorities. But he's still going to bring his God into the picture. But notice how he does it. He asks permission. He asked the head trainer. He says, he comes up to him, and it's like he doesn't come up to him with an attitude. You know, it's like, verse 10, and the commander, the official said, Daniel comes and says, hey, can we do this a different way? So verse 8 it is, he decided, he made up his mind in advance he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. There's no attitude. There's no pride. There's no arrogance. He humbles himself under this man. You know, if we teach our children anything, how is your child, when he becomes an adult, how is he going to be able to respond when he goes to work for a boss who is a jerk? And he can't come underneath that boss. Why? Because he's so mean and evil. This is exactly what Daniel's situation is. But what is he doing? He's coming under the situation. How come? Because God put him there. Just because you have a mean boss or a bad situation doesn't mean you're not supposed to be right where God put you. And so if God puts you there, he's going to give you the strength to move through the Babylonian crisis that you're in. But what he wants us to do is do it in a godly way. So what does Daniel do? He asks permission. And in fact, what he does is he works out a plan with the guy that's in charge that works for the guy that's in charge and also works for him. And then Daniel puts the results in God's hand. Look at verse number 13. Verse 12, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. You know what Daniel's just done? What Daniel has just said is this. He said, number one, I know it's not God's will for me to eat this food. But God has put me in Babylon. So what am I going to do? He decides he's not going to do it, but he goes to the king, to the king's helper, and says, I don't want to do it. Here's a plan. And then he puts the results of God's plan in God's hand. The results of his plan in God's hand. Because it's up to God whether or not at the end of the 10 days, Daniel is going to look skinny or Daniel is going to look strong. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, it's like, okay, what is the will of the Lord here? This is the will of the Lord, that I stand for God. I stand for God. And so I still come under the authority of whoever, the Babylonians that I'm at. I come up with a plan where I can talk about Jesus, or I can have a Bible study, or whatever it might be. But then I leave it in the hand of the Lord, and that's what Daniel does. The last thing I want you to see him do is this. When you are in a Babylonian crisis, do not go through that crisis by yourself. There are four young men. All four young men do this plan together. Daniel may be the one out in front. Daniel may be the one speaking, but they're all doing this plan together. God brought them here together. Put them through the exact same experience, through the exact same situation, and all of them have the exact same temptation, and what happens is they become a means of support and accountability one to the other. Now, you know what Satan will do to you and me? He will attempt to divide or to separate you or to cause you to be blind to the exact people that God has placed right around you to help you in and through a situation where you would be tempted not to rise to the level that God wants you to rise to. So he puts these people around you. He expects us to use them. He expects us to pray with them, to be strengthened by them. In fact, look over at chapter 2, verse 17. Something else, another Babylonian crisis happens, and look at what these four men do. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his home, and he informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter, in order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. God knows the difficulty of the Babylonian crises in your life. God knows how he wants to use you and I. God knows how he wants to advance his kingdom through us. And so when life becomes so much of a struggle that you and I are about to be overcome, what God will do will give you the means to go through it with other people standing beside you, using prayer, deciding how you're going to follow the Lord. But in the final analysis, what do? You put it in the hands of God. Because God's stronger than you are. God is stronger than I am. And if you're in the middle of a situation, if you are praying and asking God to help you in this situation, how do you think someone's going to ever listen to you if God's already speaking to them and they're not listening to him? The power of God's people praying and striving together for God's will causes God to open doors and close windows and put us where he wants us to be. So we close in verse 17. And look what God does. The test works. It says, and as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Visions and dreams were not even a part of the original prayer. Had nothing to do with it. Because what God does when His people walk in His will, through the temptations that Satan throws our way, what God does is He opens the doors and He blesses in abundance. Let's pray.